Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks. Well, if you could think back a year ago today, we were cleaning up and hopefully getting the lights back on very soon from Tropical Storm Isaias. It was on July 23rd, actually, that the National Hurricane Center named Isaias. And it wasn't until the morning of August 4th that we felt Isaias' presence right here in Connecticut. In fact, a portion of our state had an emergency, a tornado watch went into effect, and we kind of dealt with and sort of hunkered down and dealt with Isaias for over a week. Many people went without the lights, without power. And of course, I remember multiple times during that week having Mitch Gross with Eversource on the show. And Mitch is here now, 12 months later, looking back where Eversource has come and what we are dealing with now today. Mitch, thanks for coming back on the show. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks again for having me.
Yeah. So, Mitch, first of all, before we even dive into what has transpired 12 months later, I remember specifically when we talked a year ago today, it felt like Eversource just didn't realize it was going to be this big of an event. Is that correct? That was kind of one of the biggest reasons the response was what it was?
No, that's I have to disagree with you. We were prepared. We were prepared based on the best weather information possible at the time. And as everyone saw, the storm moved more to the west and conditions changed very rapidly. But we reacted and we went to work. But since then, you know, we haven't been sitting still at all. We've been very, very busy taking apart and putting back together all of our processes, our procedures, everything we do when it comes to storm response.
So what are some of the biggest things you would say in the last 12 months, some of the standout things that Eversource has taken on to handle things like Tropical Storm Isaias if it were to come again?
Well, you know, we got a lot of great feedback over the past year from our customers, our community leaders, our regulators, and we put them all in what's known as our emergency response plan. You know, the acronym we hear all the time here is the ERP. And we basically taken it apart, put it back together. Things such as we have new technology for our communities to connect with them, because as we all know, communications is key. And when you and I spoke numerous times during that week plus, you know, it was all about communications, keeping everyone up to date. So we now have new technology for the communities we serve. And we serve 149 of the state's 169 towns and cities. That's a huge responsibility that we were very, very much aware of. And we have something new online. It's called a municipal hub, where basically our community liaisons are better able to communicate with the communities they work with during a storm, addressing their priorities, their critical facilities, and of course, blocked roads. Blocked roads is always a major issue in any storm, and it's the ability to connect with the towns, understand where the problems are, and getting the resources out there as quickly as possible to take care of things.
So, again, we're talking to Mitch Gross this morning of Eversource. And one of the things that Mitch was just diving into, if you're just tuning in, new technologies. I do remember us talking about that in depth, Mitch. I remember you and I talking about certain municipalities saying they weren't getting the communication that they wanted and to get back to their residents. So that's certainly really encouraging to hear that for the 149 municipalities you guys service, new technologies are now in place. I've also noticed, Mitch, and maybe it's just me overanalyzing, but in the last couple of storms, even if they've just been, you know, localized storms, not tropical storms this summer, I've noticed you guys have more people answering your phones. You have more line crews coming in from other states. Was that something that we were doing before, or is that also part of your of the 12-month changes?
It's a combination. We were doing it before, but we're doing it much earlier now, and that's part of the new ERP, the Emergency Response Plan. We reach out further ahead of potential storms to get those resources into Connecticut in place, ready to go if needed.
Now, of course, Mitch, one of the big things I remember you and I talking about, people were wondering if we could avoid having these outage issues if we either put the lines under the ground. I know that you guys have been surveying trees a lot more lately. Has anything else come to fruition about how to even avoid these massive power outages?
Well, unfortunately, you can't prevent the storms from happening, but you do what you can. You prepare as best you can ahead of time. You know, you mentioned trees. We have probably one of the most comprehensive tree trimming programs in the country. You know, last year, 77% of all of our outages in Connecticut for Eversource customers were caused by trees. So, you know, we're at work all over the place, day in and day out, working with our customers and the towns to address tree issues. And unfortunately, due to conditions such as previous droughts and the emerald ash borer, the gypsy moths, other infestations, you know, the arborist will tell you we have some major tree issues across this state. Trees are dead, diseased, or dying at an unbelievable rate, and this is a huge responsibility, not only for us, but for the towns and for the state, for the Department of Transportation. You'll see the work along, for instance, the Merritt, all the work being done over the trees along the Merritt. So, you know, all of us are very busy to try to, you know, keep things as safe as possible, trim and remove hazard trees where necessary, and of course, at the same time, maintain that beauty, that balance that makes Connecticut so green and lovely.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, Mitch, I get this question a lot from our listeners. Why not bury the lines? How expensive is that?
Oh, you're talking billions and billions of dollars. You know, we have requests from towns from time to time looking to possibly put lines underground. We've done it in some cases where the towns are able to come up with the necessary funds. We're not against it by any stretch of the imagination, but there's so much that goes into it. Cost aside, just the upheaval of an area to put the lines underground. Remember, you're not just digging a trench and throwing the lines underground. You're taking everything that is on that utility pole and putting it underground. You're putting it into basically, you know, you have to construct an underground system, and you have to have the necessary room underground to put all of those lines, the electric, the cable, the phone, everything. And of course, you have gas and water already underground, so there has to be necessary room. So you're talking about a major upheaval to an area if and when such construction takes place.
After a year milestone of the Tropical Storm Isaias event, Eversource outlined last week many changes and improvements that they have made to their storm response procedures. And Mitch was going through the ERP, the Emergency Response Plan, looking at some new data functionality, some new technologies in place. There's even a new online hub that has been created for the dozens of municipalities that Eversource takes care of. And Mitch, I had one more question for you before I let you go. Recently, I was reading a report from commodity.com. I'm not sure if you saw this, but it was looking at national electric bills across the United States. And surprisingly enough, it said Bridgeport's metro area has the sixth highest electric bills. Now, of course, I know Eversource does not do Bridgeport. I made that very clear to our listeners. That is a UI city. UI covers them. But in the metro area of like Stamford, Norwalk, between those two cities alone, you're looking at over 90,000 customers who are using Eversource in those two cities. I was just curious, for the amount of money people are paying for their electricity in our metro area, do you feel better about the money, I guess, that they're spending on electricity now than we did a year ago, because so much has been now invested into Eversource basically being better for their customers?
Well, nobody likes to see their bill go up. We certainly understand that, and we do everything we can to control costs. We have a great energy efficiency program that we always encourage our customers, you know, to take advantage of. That's an interesting question, Melissa. You know, costs are up all over the place. Materials are up. The cost of doing business seems to be up everywhere, not only in the utility industry, but in multiple industries, as we continue to recover from this pandemic. So You know, I can't give you an exact answer is, but I can tell you as a customer, and I pay the same rates as every other Eversource customer out there. You know, we're always doing whatever we can to control our energy costs as well.
And Mitch Gross of Eversource, anything else that came out of this 12-month report that you want to share this morning?
Well, I think it's important to note we did not sit still right after ESA-ES. There was no time to rest, absolutely none. We certainly understand our responsibility. You know, we've had something like 10 significant storms in this state since ESA-ES. And for Eversource customers, it was something like over 400,000 outages. That's a lot of work. That's a lot of responsibility. It's something, you know, we take very, very seriously. But, you know, we're always watching the weather forecast closely every day. We're always preparing to respond to any damage or outages a storm may cause. And that's whenever a storm hits. You know, the bottom line is we're preparing and we're always encouraging our customers to prepare as well. If there's a questionable forecast, you know, they should get their storm kits together just in case. Just be prepared just in case. And, you know, we watch the weather. It seems to be changing all the time these days. And we all need to be prepared and alert and understand the situation.
Mm-hmm. And Mitch, did you feel like PURA's actions after ESA-ES, were they fair against Eversource and like UI?
Interesting question. You know, they're doing what they feel they need to do. We're appealing certain provisions in some of their recent decisions that we strongly disagree with. But in the meantime, our focus is on the future, assuring that if there's an issue, that our emergency response efforts are strong, they're robust, they take care of things, that, you know, we're keeping our customers informed, that we're keeping our employees safe on the job. The things that we need to do to keep the lights on, that's what we're focusing on.
Mitch Gross of Eversource, always a pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks for getting up early and chatting with us this morning. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Melissa. Anytime. Appreciate
it. Thank you. We appreciate it.
Fighting against injustice across Connecticut, Melissa in the Morning checks in with the Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities on WICC 600.
And this morning we have Linda Rizzo-Stowe, who's an attorney for the Commission, and talking about sexual harassment specifically in the workplace. Good morning, Linda. Thanks for being back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
So we actually are looking at some national data. According to the National Sexual Violence Resource Center, it looks like nationwide over 80% of women and 43% of men reported experiencing some form of sexual harassment and or assault in their lifetime. So it's not just women. It certainly can be men as well. So I want to make that very clear to our
listeners.
And I want to talk about the workplace specifically, because obviously there are things out of our control. We sometimes do see, unfortunately, either family or relational assault happen, which is a huge problem. We will sometimes see the random stranger, unfortunately, happen. But it does seem like a lot in the news we see workplace assault happening. And I want to talk to you about some of the things that people are fearing. Regardless of your gender, if you're fearful of retaliation or how do I even bring this up to my managers or the person doing it, how do you do it, Linda?
Sure. Well, I think, you know, referring to the term assault, if there's anything criminal about what's happening in the workplace, obviously you should also inform law enforcement. But as far as sexual harassment is concerned in the workplace, which of course can involve physical touching and assault, I think the first thing you'd want to do is look at your employer's handbook to see if they have a policy on sexual harassment. Every employer should have a sexual harassment policy that outlines the exact steps that an employee should take if he or she believes that they are being subjected to sexual harassment. Most often that involves reporting it to your manager. Of course, oftentimes it's the manager that is the harasser. So in that case, you could go to either higher management or, you know, if your company has a human resources department, you should always be able to file a complaint with them. So the first thing I would do is to look at your handbook to see what the policy provides as far as complaints are concerned.
Now, I heard you say it could involve physical. So are you saying sexual harassment isn't necessarily a physical abuse? Like, is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. Right. Sexual harassment can take many forms. Oftentimes it's the form of, you know, sexual banter, sexual comments, you know, leering. Obviously, if you have a situation where there's some type of quid pro quo going on, where, you know, a manager is looking for a sexual relationship in return for, you know, more favorable treatment at work. It's most certainly does not have to involve touching. It could for sure, but it goes beyond that as well.
So verbal abuse, that would fall under sexual harassment. It could fall under sexual harassment.
It could. When you talk about verbal abuse, sexual harassment and harassment are kind of two same but related things. So sexual harassment often involves, you know, behavior of a sexual nature. So commenting on somebody's body or appearance or making sexual jokes, you know, things like that. But harassment is also illegal if it's based upon what we call protected class. So if you have a situation where you feel you're being treated differently or harassed at work based upon things like sex, age, race, national origin, you know, anything like that, that's also illegal. So they're kind of two separate things sometimes.
So, Attorney Lynn Stowe, I'm curious then, what if you are just being bullied in the workplace? Like, in the reason I say that is not to deter from bad situations happening in a workplace. But right. If you just feel like it has nothing to do with your gender or your mm-hmm. age or anything, it's just you're that person. You're the person that's being picked on. You're the person who day in and day out, you have reached the end of your string and you feel like if I report it, I might mm-hmm. lose my job because this person makes more money for our company. This person has a better status, is very important. I'm not really in anybody. You know, there are people who feel that way and they're just the butt of the joke, if you will. And I'm not saying that lightly, but what if it's not sexual harassment? What if it's just truly feeling like, my God, I can't come to work one more day and be treated this way. What do you do then?
Well, bullying per se is not illegal. For purposes of the laws that we enforce, if the bullying is based upon, you know, one of those, you know, roughly 30 protected classes that we have in Connecticut, then certainly it would be illegal under our laws. So if you feel you have a manager who is, you know, only treating the women badly or only treating people of a certain ethnicity badly or a certain race badly, that's where the bullying becomes illegal, so to speak.
Gotcha.
You know, if you feel that, and I should mention that any complaints about that type of behavior, you know, employers are banned legally from taking any steps to retaliate against people who make those types of complaints, whether they be internally or with the commission. As far as kind of feeling like you're being picked on, but you don't really know why, I mean, I would consider that to be something that you should still talk to either your manager or your HR department about.
Okay, so, you know, and that was going to be kind of my follow-up is are there things that your management should be aware of? Say this isn't coming from a manager. Say it's just coming from, like, we have bosses upon bosses upon bosses in the radio industry. So, you know, if it's not coming from your manager but someone you work very closely to, are there things that as a manager or as an HR director you should be more aware of or taking more of a stance on?
Well, I think that any complaint that is made by one of your employees should, you know, obviously be taken seriously and investigated. So I think that you know, if it is like a coworker on coworker situation, you know, the onus is on the employee who is experiencing their harassment to bring that to the attention of somebody, either in management or human resources, so that the employer can do something about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, really interesting information. And Linda Stowe, attorney for a Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities, looking at sexual harassment in the workplace. Is there a way that someone could contact you if they want your resources or your help on any of this?
Yes, absolutely. We have a website. It is ct.gov/CHRO, and all of our contact information is on there. If people have concerns about anything in the workplace, they should absolutely give us a call, and we will help them out however we can.
Linda, thanks for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care.
The last time we had Bob Donovan on, our marriage consultant, we were talking about two points of view, whether or not it's appropriate to have friendships with the opposite gender once you get married. We heard the good side and we heard the bad side. And then we had to wrap things up and go to the next part, which is, so what do you do? What do you do if your spouse has a close friend of the opposite gender? Let's say you and your spouse get into a fight. They lean on their friend who is of the opposite gender. Is it a good idea? Not a good idea? What do you do to handle this situation? Bob Donovan is back this morning to talk a little bit about this. Good morning, Bob.
Hi, Melissa. How are you doing today?
I'm fine. Thank you. So, how do you sort of handle this situation? I know you and I both have friends of the opposite gender, and it works for our marriages, but for others, it may be a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, it is. So I guess one thing is, this could expose a blind spot. So if you're not willing to look at your relationship, your marriage relationship and this friend relationship, I mean, that could be a red flag right there. I would start by saying that people with opposite sex friends should certainly proceed with caution and handle with care. They really need to go into this with eyes wide open and being able to, the word I use is being brutally honest with yourself to assess your marriage relationship and your friend relationship. And what do I mean by that? So as an example, the length of your friendship is really key. So I think, did I remember you correctly that your friend is like a childhood friend?
We've been friends since middle school.
There you go. That's a long-term relationship, right? That's one variable. I know mine is 25 years. She's a friend that I had a work relationship with at Pfizer. If it's a newer friend, I think that's a little risk. And I would certainly say not to establish new friends with people of the opposite gender if you're married. I would definitely say that. But if it's a longer term relationship, again, I think that's just a check mark you just look at. I also think you look at your emotional health of your friend and your marriage. If your marriage is a little weak right now, if you're having conflict, probably not a good idea to run to your friend. So I think there's some variables to look at. Again, it starts with kind of being brutally honest with it, to look at your relationship, your marriage relationship, and your friend relationship. Okay, I think there's other things to do. That's more general. I think there's some practical, specific questions to ask. And again, I'll throw them out if you want to comment. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. But obviously, I know Derek is well aware. I think you even mentioned that you brought Derek into that relationship. And that's great. I don't think that's always necessary. But one thing that is necessary is your spouse fully aware of your opposite gender friendship? Mm-hmm. Fully. Do they know everything? What you talk about, how often you meet? I like that. So are they aware of everything? A question to ask yourself is, do you behave differently around your friend because of your friendship? I'm saying that wrong. Excuse me. Let me backtrack. rewind the tape. Would you behave differently around your friend if your spouse was there? Okay, think about that.
Sure. No, that's a really good red flag. That's a really good red flag.
Yeah,
sure.
I mean, again, what I said, be brutally honest, because if you said no and you would change your conversation, that's a red flag. That's a red flag. Mm-hmm. How about this one? Would you feel uncomfortable if your spouse had the same quality of friendship with someone of the opposite sex?
So like if your spouse was hanging out or doing the same things that you were doing with this friend, if they had their own friend, would you feel comfortable
exactly.
with it? Yeah,
exactly
that
right.
I've had to ask myself that question before.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Right.
Yep. That's a great question.
Again, it's got to be brutally honest. You can rationalize this. You could easily say that. But
sure.
If you're really honest, right? Mm-hmm. And Derek or Karen had that kind of a friendship, like, how would you feel about that?
True.
Right? And also just a few more. Would you, if you're getting brutally honest, do you have any flirtatious or romantic fantasies or thoughts about your friend? And if there's any yes to that at times, even if it's only a few, like, that's a high risk and you have to make a change.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's some specific questions to ask, I guess to assess your opposite sex friends.
Here's a quick question for that, Bob. And again, we're talking to Bob Donovan, our marriage consultant on the show, if it's appropriate to have friends of the opposite gender. Now, I want to make this very clear. This does not pertain to my friendship with I've said him before, Connor, my one of my best friends who I've known since I was in middle school. However, I have seen other couples where they remain friends with somebody who they either used to date, they used to romantically be involved, or they used to have feelings for each other, you know, eons ago. Is that appropriate to remain friends?
I would say no.
You'd say no. You would walk away from that. Even if you've lost all interest on both sides, it's just not even worth opening the can of worms.
Yeah. Let's go back to the last segment. That, again, there's 60 research. There's data. There's research on this. 66%, two thirds of affairs start with people that used to be friends, that used to have a romantic relationship. So there's ample data that says and what I'm saying is the risk is too high. Okay, I'm not saying that's not going to work. I'm saying the risk is too high.
But would you say, though, Bob, that it then makes you question, like, if you're putting, you know, parameters around who you could be friends with or not, doesn't that then question how much you trust your spouse?
Possibly, but I think, you see, I'm landing on the key question, is this too risky? You see? So the answer might be no to that, but I think I'm going back to the data. There's just too much risk involved. You know, marriages are falling
apart
by the wayside by the week. So this is another element of risk involved. And do you want to entertain that?
Mm-hmm.
See, I'm not saying you shouldn't do that. I'm just saying, man, it's just too risky to do this when the data says that that two thirds of affairs start like this. You see?
Yeah, that's a heavy piece of data. No, I can agree with that.
Yeah, it's almost preventative. It's almost preventative. And
right.
I know but you know what? Sometimes you have to make hard decisions to preserve and protect your marriage. And a lot of people don't do that.
Yeah. No, you make a good point. And Bob, unfortunately, we've run out of time. But I think this is a topic that I would imagine a lot of couples, or at least people who are in relationships, are struggling with right now. I think this is a very, very good topic. And they probably want to dive more into it beyond this 5-minute interview. So is there a way that they can contact you?
Yep. I'd love to answer that two ways. One is I would end with this, that if your spouse communicates any concerns about this, it should end. I really, really strongly believe that. So that's one thing I will end. If couples want to elaborate, communicate on this, I'd love to hear from them. Actually, the best way is email bdonovan, D-O-N-O-V-A-N, at blackrock.org.
All right. Bob, always a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much.
All right, Melissa.
All right, have a great rest of your day.